PopCast is supported in part by HelloFresh, the meal kit delivery service dedicated to making cooking fun, easy, and convenient, delivered right to your door. For $30 off your first week of deliveries, visit HelloFresh.com and enter promo code NYTPOP30 when you subscribe.
This episode of PopCast is brought to you by Random House, publishers of Last Hope Island by New York Times bestselling author Lynn Olson. Hailed A Rip-Roaring Saga by Eric Larson, Last Hope Island recounts an untold World War II story about the perilous days when the British joined forces with European exiles and stood together to combat the mightiest military force in history. Last Hope Island is available now wherever books are sold.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your deeply invasive 16-question questionnaire about your emotional state of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. With a sickness, everybody. Feist is back. You were just listening to Pleasure, which is the title track from Pleasure, which is, depending if you believe Wikipedia or Joe Coscarelli, Feist's fourth or fifth album.
We don't count the first one that was sold mostly at shows.
I don't know. My feeling is I would prefer Monarch Lay Your Jeweled Head Down to this new record.
It sounds like a CDR to me.
That sounds lit. FYI, I'm here. I am joined by the pop music Illuminati in the New York Times to unpack this deeply, I'm just going to say it, this deeply unchallenging Feist record. I know I'm in a minority at this table, but I'm just going to go in hard at the top. I've got chief pop music critic John Fareles.
Hi there.
I've got pop music reporter Joe Coscarelli, whose calves are still hurting from all the long walks he took with Feist.
It's true.
For a feature that came out.
We clocked some miles. If I had my step counter.
Yeah, what, you got a Fitbit?
I don't have a Fitbit.
Yeah, that's on brand. It would be off brand if you had a Fitbit. It'd be off brand if you had a Fitbit.
Yes.
So we are going to talk today about Feist, who had a career moment and then had a retrenchment and now is doing something that seems, I would venture to say, pre-breakthrough. Does that feel right in terms of sonic approach or like breakthrough era sonics?
Post-breakthrough? Some version of that. I think
it's not what the last record was.
It's not really.
It's sort of the opposite of what the last record was.
Right, which is more the point I'm trying to make.
And definitely the opposite of the album that came before that, which was her big sort of commercial moment, the reminder.
So let's talk a little bit about the sonics of Pleasure. JP, what's your vibe on this vis-a-vis metals and vis-a-vis the reminder of the last two Feist records?
She's a very considered performer, musician, producer. So this is a big change. I mean, there's tape hiss on this. There's a couple of instruments. It usually starts out pretty sparse, and then something loud happens in
yes.
the middle. She reminds me of the whole lo-fi movement. I mean, particularly Guided by Voices, where it's just her and the instruments she has at hand, and some hissy recording device, and a lot of urge to get some music out.
Shouts to that boy, Bob Pollard.
True.
I'm more of a Feist fan than you,
yes,
obviously.
Yes, no, I know. I'm just here for the lulls.
There aren't a lot of lulls on this album.
No. There's just a lot of lulls in me listening to this record. It's really where they're at.
You get your heart broken and then put it
He
on.
Has no heart.
You know what I learned? You know what I learned? The real lull is inside you. That's where the real lull is. Yeah, so a lot of the songs do this thing. They open whispery. They, Feist has some gnomic lyrics. About
they seem more straightforward, actually, than the last
There's album. There's a few gnomes. And then it opens up about halfway through to some kind of something that doesn't approximate metal so much, but it does approximate maybe her like higher gloss stuff on the previous album.
But never with any sonic joy. Like before there used to be horns, there used to be harmonica or glockenspiel or, you know, some...
Yeah, there's no shiny stuff on this.
There's nothing shiny.
But let's talk about where all that stuff originally came from. Let's talk a little bit about her Canadian crew and the people who she was hanging out with. Because my feeling is a lot of that stuff from the early records is really sort of like conceptual spin-off stuff from...
Broken Social Scene.
Yes. Yeah, so Feist comes out of sort of two overlapping scenes in Toronto and in Canada, and then that sort of spread out to Paris and Berlin, and that's the world of Arts and Crafts Records, Broken Social Scene, this Canadian supergroup, which has anywhere between 10 and 42 members, depending on the night and the album and the song. Feist was a vocalist. She wrote some songs on their earlier albums. Kevin Drew is sort of the de facto
the anchor,
leader of
yeah.
that crew mm-hmm. and the camp counselor and the spirit animal.
And the former boyfriend.
Oh, snap. I did not know that.
Yes, that's true. And then she has another group of collaborators that she knew, I think, even earlier in her life. That includes Peaches. They had a punk band, I believe, at one point.
I think there were puppets involved as well.
Yeah, some, you know, a lot of art school stuff.
It sounded lit, but then when you said puppets, it sounded not lit.
So another longtime collaborator, Chili Gonzalez, who is, you know, producer, pianist, sort of
keyboardist, supreme
jack of all trades yeah. in the studio. Amaki, another producer that she's worked with for most of her career, who is one of the few people involved in this record, which she says started as a sort of solo project. All of these albums are under Feist, but usually she's bringing in all of these collaborators. And what she told me in the course of our interviews was that she felt like she had come to depend on them a little bit too much. And she was leaning on, you know, having these giant arrangements that went to all of these, you know, more perhaps jubilant places. And just based on where she was in her life, she felt like she needed to scale back and make this album essentially by herself.
So, Joe, you talked to Feist a lot.
Feist and I spent many hours together.
Yeah. What was your overall umbrella read on her emotional place right now?
She's hard to pin down. She's definitely someone who has only ever known playing in bands and going on tour and traveling. And, you know, you can't tie her down geographically. You can't really tie her down musically. And it's also hard to tie her down in conversation. John Perales, you've also spent some time with her.
But I always enjoy talking to her because her entire brain works in metaphors.
Yes. She's, you know, she's a very smart, very intelligent woman. She has a lot of ideas about creation and human emotions and feelings. And she's sort of...
She thinks in images, though.
Yes.
I mean, even a lot of the quotes from your story... There's always some, like, physical image
yes.
to go with the emotion that she's trying to
yes.
convey.
Yes, and a lot of the times we were talking about emotions around pleasure, it was weather. She was thinking a lot about weather systems and the way that dark clouds sort of approximate her tendency to slip into periods of anxiety and depression and isolation, and those are the sorts of themes that she's... seems to be wrestling with on this album.
At the end of your piece, you talk about her time on some island somewhere.
So one of the things about Feist that she and I sort of wrestled with over the days we spent together is this idea of her as a nomad, and how she said that at one point she challenged herself to stay in one place for like 6 months, and that it was very difficult for her to accomplish that. So she's constantly going around the world, not only for shows as part of her work, but as a solo adventurer. So one of these trips that she takes more regularly is she goes to an island in Canada that, you know, has no electricity and you have to reach it by boat. And she rents a sort of shanty shack there where she, you know, uses a hot plate and reads and swims. She swims around the whole island and she seems to be really the only person there. And that's the sort of solitude.
The vibe of the album.
That's the vibe of the album, and that's mm-hmm. the sort of solitude that she seeks out, but then also wrestles with her desire to always be finding these new places where she can be alone. And she's sort of resisting those impulses within herself.
Let's maybe play The Wind.
The wind comes from this island, as you can tell.
That it does. So a little bit of the wind from Feist.
It brings hail from old water. storm on his knees and flags from a revolution that brought us some peace. And the trees for their 100 years lean north like a lake of fear. And I'm shaped by my storm man, like fish shaped by the storm man.
Popcast is sponsored by Penguin Random House Audio. If you're a big fan of the latest music info and behind-the-scenes takes on the music industry, then we have the audiobook for you. Penguin Random House Audio publishes many music-related audiobooks, from books about Billy Joel and Moby to the Grammy-nominated Under the Big Black Sun, about the Los Angeles punk rock movement and its evolution to hardcore punk. Visit penguinrandomhouseaudio.com/music for more listening suggestions.
Okay, so my feeling is to properly contextualize this record, we probably should talk about older Feist. We should also talk about older Feist because I find it more tolerable than current Feist. So let's talk a little bit about Metals. Metals is the previous record. Metals came out 4 years ago? Six years ago. Came out in 2011.
She's been gone a long time.
Yeah, Feist is on her Frank Ocean disappearance dip. But Metals is her mildly complicated record in response to an uncomplicated and successful period. But let's talk a little bit about what was going on Metals, since we have not discussed Feist previously on the podcast. So this will hopefully be new to listeners. What was going on Metals?
Well, Metals was some very imagistic songs and some very elaborate arrangements. And I thought it was a beautiful album. And I made it my number one album of the year that year. Which I see John making terrible faces.
I think it's the most coherent Feist record. That's what I got. That's what I got. It's the most coherent Feist record.
But also, it's very melodic. It's got horns. It's got all kinds of elaborate backing vocal arrangements. It's very meticulous. She was working at the time with, I think, both Gonzalez and Maki, and they are craftsmen. I talked to, I think, Gonzalez about the reminder, and he said, we wanted to make a banger. So Metals has songs that I think were not particularly poppy songs because they were ambiguous and emotionally complicated and beautifully melodic and wonderfully arranged to my ear, but not exactly bangers.
Let's listen to one of those songs. What song should we listen to?
We're going
to
play Bittersweet Melodies.
Bittersweet Melodies by Feist.
Leaking kitchen floor. Snow slips under. Speakers were singing. Telephone always rang. Yeah, with those bittersweet melodies, like a sweet memory. Bittersweet melodies. Can't go back and can't go on.
The thing about Feist is, commercially, she's always going to have 1.5 hits, right? Musha Boom and 1, 2, 3, 4.
I feel it all to some extent.
She
has a handful of
greatest hits. She has a handful of hits. But to me, she's not a one-hit wonder or a three-hit wonder.
She's a no-hit wonder?
No, to me, it's not about the hits.
Right.
I mean, she's the kind of, pardon the expression, artist that I want to hear what she's up to.
Then let's talk about common threads in that case. Hits or non-hits, whatever aside, there must be something that's unifying everything that's going on in Metals with everything that's going on Pleasure, with everything that was going on Let It Die and Remind. What are the things that you think are the steady threads? Because like you say, it's not her Metal Machine music. It's not like she completely jumped off the deep end.
No, they're beautiful songs.
So what are the common unifying forces that link all of her creative work?
Her voice, mostly. It's a gentle voice with a steel core.
Mm.
And I hear her inflections a lot in other people these days.
So where are you hearing this feisty, some could say, quality in vocals?
I hear it in a lot of indie rock singers. I mean, it's in Sylvanesso, for one thing, who were her backup band. Amita Meath was bagging her up and probably could do perfect feist harmonies because their voices are so similar. But I also hear it in a lot of other singers, just like those little sort of breathy inflections that Feist does. So she's been influential, even though the hits are a bit in the past now.
I feel like you kind of can't talk about Feist without doing what we're about to do, which is play 1, 2, 3, 4.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 9, or 10. Money can't buy you back the love that you had then. Oh, I'm changing your heart. Oh, you know who you are. Oh, you're changing your heart. Oh, you know who you are.
Now, to be fair, if I was a singer and that was my hit song, I would probably also try to retreat from it. That's a tough record to have be your big record.
It's really tough.
It was an early iPod Apple commercial or
iPhone?
Yeah,
I believe iPod Nano. It was before the iPhone.
Yeah, it was pre-iPhone, right?
Pre-iPhone. And the funny thing about that song for someone with a career like Feist is that she didn't even write it. So it was written by this woman, New Buffalo, who she was on tour with and didn't feel like it fit with her kind of music. And Feist started playing it on the tour they were on together. And then before you know it, Leslie Feist is on Sesame Street counting to 4. So this, you know, this...
I did watch that clip after reading your piece, and I felt bad. I felt bad for her.
She hit her marks, though.
She did, for sure. But
she
didn't look happy.
But, you know, and I don't think it's that she's ashamed. Like, she, you know, she's happy to play it when necessary. But I think that she's an album artist. She's a catalog artist for the people who like her. And this is not representative necessarily for music. And I think because of this song and I Feel It All and Mushaboom, sort of maybe her big three, she gets this reputation, which I touched on in my piece, for this sort of like indie rock, twee, folk singer, Zooey Deschanel world. And when you listen to Pleasure, especially, that's not really the person that you're getting. So if you're the Starbucks customer, Feist fan, Pleasure's probably not the album for you.
I don't think there's that much difference between Let It Die and Pleasure. I understand there is some musical difference, but I don't feel like there's that much conceptual difference.
I just think my mom likes the first couple Feist albums. Damn. I think this one's a little much for her emotionally.
Because of the spare parts, you know, the empty parts, basically, the early halves of the songs.
It's in your face in its sort of minimalism. It's austere. It can be a little cold. It gets clangy. You know, the guitars break. It sounds like somebody who's dealing with a lot of uncertainty emotionally and maybe trying to center themselves in reaching their 40s and having had this strange career where you go from a struggling touring musician to this uber famous person to somebody who pulls back from that completely. I think, like, you know, in doing the research for this piece, one of the really hilarious things to me was that Feist was nominated for Best New Artist at the Grammys after The Reminder alongside Taylor Swift, Paramore, Popcast favorite, Amy Winehouse, favorite of people everywhere. She just doesn't quite fit in that world. And she said, you know, she compared going to
I'm almost surprised she didn't win, given the Grammys, Grammy history.
She described going to that ceremony as like visiting Buckingham Palace. She was like, you know, there was interesting stuff to look at, but I didn't really quite fit in.
Let's listen to one of those songs that are like how you just described this new album, which is A Man Is Not His Song.
They make it up in the sense in depilation. Eventually, it can let you down by leaping into an innovation. Somewhat lift up in me by reaping so. Oh, sweet, I will.
I have to say, though, it is good advice to do not date musicians.
I'll let you know if I ever do. Okay, so A Man Is Not His Song is, to me, it's one of the more striking songs on this record, one of the ones I appreciated the most. But it's also very consistent with what I alluded to at the beginning of the podcast, which is a 16-question questionnaire of emotional invasion. And that is not a thing that I made up. That is a real thing that is currently in the hands of Joe Coscarelli. And he talks about it in his piece slightly, but he brought it for us today. Joe, what's really good on that sheet of paper?
So before I met with Leslie Feist, the circumstance under which we met, we went for a walk in Central Park on one day in February, spent many hours just walking around in circles, talking about what her life has been like for the last 5 or 6 years. And then a couple weeks later, we met up in LA where she's been living and went on a similar walk, except it was a hike because we were in LA. So that's what you do. But before any of that, I got an email forwarded to me from her representative at the label, from Leslie Feist, saying, if you'd be willing, here's a list of questions I'd like you to answer for me. I promise I won't read them until long after we've met. You know, I'm not going to make these public, but I'd like to know these things about you.
And just for the record, like, this is not a thing that happens in celebrity interviews.
No, never.
Like, this is not a thing. And I say that both because No celebrity has actual time to read responses to the questionnaires, but also most celebrities don't care who you are as a human being.
And
so let's just put that out there.
Sure.
So just the fact that this is an entry point for Feist is interesting in and of itself. It's good data.
Right. And so when I open this thing, you know, I'm thinking, okay, I'll play along. And then I realize I should probably go to therapy before I play along to these games that she wants to play.
How much of this questionnaire are you going to read?
I'm going to read a couple. So
read my favorite one.
It starts off, who do you trust most and why? You know, a deep question, but fair.
But like not something that like if you met someone at a bar and had a good conversation with them, maybe an hour or two of that conversation.
Sure.
Maybe
and to be fair, she acknowledged this. You know, in her email, she says it'd be hard to know if even within a lifetime of friendship, some of these topics in the questionnaire would be tackled, which for sure. Because then it goes on to say, what are 10 words to describe the way you experience your sadness? That's, you know, pretty heavy. What makes you feel tenderness? What's one of your secrets that maybe doesn't need to be a secret anymore? Recall your most shameful memory and describe how it
changed
you.
Is anybody trying these on like Tinder? This is a good like Tinder strategy.
No, I think
this is like that love question.
Next time you click with someone on Raya, just like drop these on them.
So this is the pleasure questionnaire, which, you know, and I think
it seems pretty joyless.
And that's part of the joke, I think, of this album being called Pleasure, because it mostly feels, to me at least, like pain.
You didn't read my favorite question.
Which one's your favorite? I thought it was the most shameful memory.
Oh, did you read that one?
Okay, I'll read it one more time. Recall your most shameful memory and describe how it changed you. In retrospect, was it for the better or worse?
Yeah, you didn't read that before.
I did. You were just talking over me.
Oh, that's fine. Then I'm doing my job.
So, you know, this is heavy stuff, but I think it is a very accurate reflection of the kinds of questions she was turning over at this point in her life.
Well, also, it's the kind of questions the songs probably answer obliquely in
obliquely,
some places.
Yes.
Deeply obliquely. Like very tray obliquely.
Right. And I think, you know, in speaking with her, it wasn't that she expected to crack these existential queries wide open and feel like she really found the answers to how to be a person. But I think she wanted to remind herself that these are the type of things that are a work in progress and that at different periods in your life, you're going to have different answers to these questions, and that's okay. And I think she also, one of the things she said to me was that she wanted to remind herself that it didn't always have to be extreme sadness or extreme happiness, and she wanted to find a way to sort of exist in a more stable emotional frequency, put it that way.
With that, let's listen to the last song on Pleasure, which is called Young Up.
Young Up. You're young punk. The end.
Thank you for listening to the New York Times podcast about Feist, which I hope will not be my most shameful memory. Thank you to my guests, John Pareles and Joe Coscarelli. You can listen to every podcast ever, and I highly recommend you do that at nytimes.com/podcast. You can email us and tell us your feelings about Feist, or maybe even answer some of the questions on Feist's questionnaire.
Shameful memories welcome.
Yeah, I'm putting out a call for shameful memories. So please, podcast at nytimes.com. Share a shameful memory with us. You can subscribe to the podcast anywhere you get your audio content, be that Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, I've heard recently. Our producer is Pedro Rosado. We will be back next week.